Before we get started, we want to thank Purple for sponsoring PD Stories. Get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress when you text PD to 84888.
This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris, Jr. My guest today is Mark DeMeo. Mark was on the NYPD for 20 years before retiring at the rank of detective.
He's like a wide receiver. He's like 6'1", 165 pounds. He kicks me, and my back is to him, in the back of the leg, and then breaks away from my partner and takes off.
He's gone on to make a name for himself as an actor and comedian, appearing on Comics Watching Comics, and recently had a role on Law & Order SVU.
And especially when you get a laugh, it's nothing like it, really. It's a beautiful thing, man. It's like riding a wave. I've done tons of shows with Bill Burr, Jim Gaffigan, Dave Chappelle, Tracy Morgan, the cast of SNL, you name it.
He also does comedy acts for good causes, like his Stand Up for Autism show that bring awareness to important issues. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
What's up, Tom? Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this day, man. I've been looking forward to talking to you. Now, you're a New York native, right?
I sure am.
Tell me a little bit about your family and where you grew up in the city.
I'm here from New York. My parents came here in like 1964. My mother came from Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And my father came from Dominican Republic, and they both lived in Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. They met while they were going to English-speaking school. And my father supposedly used to, you know, you're supposed to talk to somebody before the class starts, you know, to practice your English, uh-huh. right? So my father used to pick my mother because she's, you know, she's from Czechoslovakia. She's beautiful, blonde hair, green eyes. So he used to go up to her, and then one day he says to her, I walked by your house last night, you know, to practice the English. And she said, okay, 6 o'clock. And he said, no. I walked back by your house last night. And she goes, okay, 6 o'clock. So and he took her out on a date. The rest is history. And they didn't last long, by the way. Before you know it, my mother moved to Astoria, Queens. And then my father lived in Washington Heights. He stayed there. And so I pretty much spent a lot of time in Astoria, Queens until the middle of, it wasn't even the middle of the third grade. I think it was the second month, October of third grade. I was asked to leave the New York City public school system.
They kicked you out in the third grade?
Well, they recommended boarding school. I needed a little bit more attention than that the New York City public school system could spare. Apparently, I like to talk, basically. So I would talk all class, I would disrupt it, and then they put me in this like military school, which straightened me out, by the way, mm-hmm. immediately.
And you finished high school amazing. And military school?
The military school was good. I mean, it was. I used to come home on the weekends. And then I'd go most of the time to Astoria. But I never could really, like, settle in and have, you know, the real group of friends because I was, like, torn between these three things, the Washington Heights, the Astoria, and then going to the military school. So I kind of sort of, once I got out of there and I went to high school in Astoria, then I started settling in. Then I started becoming, like more from Astoria, you know. And I really enjoyed high school. You know, high school, I went to St. John's Prep. I was really good at being a teenager.
What does that mean?
I was it, man. I was a party, man. I was a living embodiment of the 80s, man. I used to break dance. I had a mullet. I had a mustache. People look at my throwback pictures. They can't believe it.
And I'm Beat Street, huh?
They're like, I can't believe you had a mustache. I'm like, everybody in the 80s had a mustache. You know, even girls had mustaches.
And we had a saying back in the 80s, never trust a man that doesn't have a mustache.
I know, really. Right? Yeah. Well, you still have one, right?
But I would till the day I die.
Yeah, yeah. It looks good on you.
Thank you.
It looks good on you.
Thank you. Now, let me ask you this. How did you get into law enforcement?
So once I got out of high school, I didn't really have a plan. And I spent 5 years in a 2-year college, community college. And then after that, you know, everybody who cares about you in the neighborhood, they start telling you, you know, hey, you should probably take all the city tests. You know what I'm saying? Like the people that can see you, you're going to wind up going nowhere quick. So I was working as a doorman and I thought, you know, I got to do something. So I took the FDNY test and I took the NYPD test and I took the state trooper test. Mm-hmm. And actually, NYPD was the first out of the three that called. So I went into class. It was I was the midnight class, June 30th, 1992.
What does that mean, midnight class?
Well, because we came in under this It was called Safe Streets, Safe Cities. It was a federal program. Mayor Dinkins got money from the federal government because we were just getting through the crack epidemic at the time. So nobody knew that the crack epidemic was ending, but it really was at that time. It was kind of dwindling down, but they were getting that federal funding because of that. And I was part of that. I was part of a group of 3,000 recruits that went in that night. We got sworn in at Brooklyn Tech High School.
3,000?
Yeah.
A class of 3,000 rookies?
Yep.
Wow.
We also got sworn in. That was the midnight class. And what they told you is don't quit your job until after you get sworn in, just to make sure the money was there. So I remember after we swore in, then everybody had a chance. They took like a 15-minute break so you could call up your job and tell them you're not coming back.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So you start as a rookie, and what was New York City like at that time when you came on the streets in what year was this, 1991?
1992. It was a much different New York compared to now. The neighborhoods were racially separated. It was very, very obvious. There was running jokes comedians used to do all the time. You know, I remember one comedian used to have a joke like he was white and he just got here, and then he was like 96th Street. And somebody came up to him on the subway. They had reached like 96th Street. He goes, "Oh, my friend, this is your stop.
Get off here, huh?
Yeah, this is where you should get off." And there's a lot of jokes about it, but you could look through the New York history, look up Howard Beach. Howard Beach was a homicide because a couple of boys had...
The guy beaten with the baseball bat?
Yeah, they got chased. And it was all because they were, what at the time was, in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time.
Yeah, for those who don't know, that incident was a young black guy went into a neighborhood in Howard Beach out in Queens.
Yeah.
And a group of young white guys saw him, chased him with baseball bats.
I think if I remember, they chased him, it might have been onto the highway. They chased him with bats onto the highway, and I think he got hit by a car on the highway. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but it was a bad situation.
It was bad. That was riots. That time was a lot of riots. Mm-hmm. There was always something. It was Crown Heights. Then it was Howard Beach.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember your first arrest?
Yeah, I do, man.
What happened?
I had a foot post. It was in Queens. I worked in the 102, and I was on Queens Boulevard right across the street from the criminal court there. And it was a guy. There's always some guy at a bus stop or in a train. It's like, you know, this crazy person that's overly aggressive and just grilling everybody. And, you know, part of police work is a lot of it's like pet peeves. I always hated that person when I was a civilian. So I seen the guy was walking around the bus stop, you know, flexing in front of people, trying to scare them, trying to intimidate them. And I just told the guy to take a walk. And I in my mind, I knew he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I said, get out of here before I lock you up. And then he came back again. So then I went after him and he went inside it was a Chirping Chicken there. So at the time, I was a brand new rookie, and I actually had to call my sergeant for permission to lock this guy up.
Why'd you have to call for permission?
Well, he had to evaluate it and determine that it was an arrestable offense. So when he got there, I articulated what I witnessed and why I wanted to arrest him. And then he said, okay. So then I went inside Chirping Chicken, and I grabbed him.
Did he resist?
He tried to a little bit, but I was bigger than him, and... Mm-hmm. I knew my way around, so it wasn't really much of a struggle.
And you also had a stolen car arrest pretty early on in your rookie year, right?
Well, that was my second arrest. Also, I was in what's called FTU, Field Training Unit. That one, this kid was stealing a Isuzu Tracker or something like that, and the guy came out, spooked him. So he ran away, and the guy lived right next to a highway. So he hurdled the ledge there. I don't know if he knew how far the drop was onto the Van Wyck Expressway, but it was about 25 feet. And when he hit the deck, he broke his leg. And it turns out that the kid had something when he was younger, where his bones were brittle.
Mm.
So he just lay there, and I was like, hey, don't go anywhere. I'll be right down there. Got the car. We went all the way around. He was like literally right off the highway.
And then he had to go to jail, at hospital, then jail, right?
Yeah. Yep, that's exactly what happened. He went to the hospital and then jail.
So you started out in the 102nd Precinct in Queens.
Richmond Hill, yeah.
And what was the neighborhood like at that time?
Pretty diversified. There was there's an Indian part of it. And they have the parade every year where they throw the die. That was a big deal. And then it was also very Spanish,
mm-hmm.
Latin. I would say Ecuador, Colombian, some Puerto Rican, like that. And in that precinct, too, on 101st Avenue, that's where one of the social clubs that John Gotti used to have. And every year he used to throw the 4th of July party there, mm-hmm. which was insane. It was burgers, hot dogs, fireworks. I didn't get to be too many of them because I didn't really spend too much time in the 102. I basically just did my FTU there. I did my 6 months. I went to this, it was called Queens Task Force. At the time, they were taking, these task forces used to have big cops. I'm 6'4". I was a bodybuilder at the time. And so I went to work there. We did a civil unrest. If there was a protest, if there was a march, if there was a big party, like we used to always have to go down to like clubs. Like in the 103, they had this Trafalgar Square.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody was in the club because there was 2,000 people outside the club. Like, why is everybody here? Why don't you go in the club? Nobody would go in the club. And they'd hang out there, and then they'd send, like,
so
the task force.
It's crowd control work.
Yeah. And it was, like, only 8 of us working one night, and my boss, we used to call him Shaky G.
Why'd you call him Shaky G?
Because he was too shaky to be a boss, you know?
Ah, okay.
So he gives it, we line up. We always have to line up before we did things. So it's like, so we could look, you know, authoritative. So he lined up. He goes, all right. And he's looking down at like 2,000 people. There's 8 of us. He goes, all right, let's just go down there and see what happens. I'm like, that's the best you got?
There's a strategy.
That is the best you got, Sarge. We booed him the whole way, walked down there.
Well, you know, it's funny. My first case I did on America's Most Wanted in 1993 was a murder case in East New York, Brooklyn, the 75th Precinct. It became somewhat notorious later on in history. But, you know, I first worked the case with these older detectives that had been on since, like, late 50s, early 60s. And they were like a whole different breed than the younger ones. You know, you were coming around the same time as a rookie at that time. And those older, saltier detectives were a different breed, right?
Yep. Yeah. I'll give you a perfect example. When I got to this detective squad, I was working in Harlem, and there was a robbery complaint that came in. He says, I was walking down Broadway, and when I got to 124th Street, a minivan pulls over. Some guy jumps out, points a gun at him, and tells him to empty out his pockets. So then he collects all the stuff. He jumps back in the minivan, takes off. It was $600 in cash. So I'm a rookie detective, you know, in the detective squad now. Not a rookie, but I'm a brand new detective, and I'm taking this report verbatim. Whatever he says, I'm writing on the report. This salty detective that with tons of time, like, you know, he already had 30 years on at the time. He says, hey, kid, do you mind if I have a word with him, a talk with him? I said, no, go ahead. Johnny Rowe was his name. Go ahead, John. John takes a chair. He spins it around. And now he's got his hands over the chair like this. He goes, where'd you get the money? And I go, excuse me? He goes, where'd you get the money? And he starts telling him, from work. And he says, what do you do? You know, construction. He starts telling him, where do you work construction? Who's your boss? When do you get paid? Is it by check? Is it by cash? Man, it was not even a minute and a half of quick. Okay. I gambled the money. My wife's going to kill me.
He gave
it up right away. He told him, get out of here before I lock you up. The guy left. I still to this day do not know how he knew that guy was lying. But even if I look back on it, I still would have probably taken the report verbatim. But there's something that he knew, man. There's something that those crusty guys, man, those old-time detectives.
And then there was stuff they didn't know. I remember I was back in D.C. and I called a detective one time, one of the older ones, and I said, hey, can you FedEx me the report? And I hear him go, hold on a minute. Hey, Al, what's FedEx? and I'm like, okay.
They didn't know computers for nothing. Same guy I'm talking about, Johnny Rowe, could spot somebody lying in a second. Man, when we were switching over, because when I was in the detective squad, we were still using
typewriters,
the pink sheets. Mm-hmm. It was the pink copy was the top copy. That's the one that used to go on your file.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're switching to doing our what's called a DD5 system. We're starting to use the computer. And man, I was what's this button? You know, it's like to start off with somebody like, what's this button? No, this is going to take a while.
Now, did you ever have to fire your weapon in the course of your career as a law enforcement officer?
Everybody always asks you that when you're at a party. First of all, I always tell people when we go to a party, I tell my friends, whatever you do, don't tell anybody I'm a cop. all right, sure, no problem, bro. And then they go, yo, it's not about you all the time. Why is it all? I said, just do me a favor. We go in the party. Don't tell anybody I'm a cop. As soon as we get in, hey, that's my buddy Mark. He's a cop. And then inevitably somebody will come up to you and they'll be like, hey, yo, you know, this and that.
You ever shot anybody?
You ever shot? And if you say no, you just became the most boring person in the room, man. They're like, really? 20 years a cop? You never shot anybody? Well, you writing tickets? And they just like walk away from you mid-sentence. You know what I'm saying? So then I started getting creative. I told this one guy one time, I says, you know what? I'd rather not talk about it if that's okay. And he was like, what? Hey, man, that guy was involved in something, man. Yeah. He didn't want to talk about it.
Don't look him in the eye. Now, you're an outgoing guy. You got a great sense of humor. And do you think your personality had a lot to do with how you were able to not get in situations that escalated to the ultimate level of use of force?
Well, obviously, that's a tremendous asset. Tremendous asset. Being from New York, being speaking the language, so to speak, you know, you get a lot of cops in New York that they come from, you know, upstate or way out in Long Island. And even though you live technically in New York, New York City's a different, you know, there's a language that they speak up into their own, that they know how to communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm. And that's New Yorkers in general.
Yeah, like if you bump into somebody and you're somewhere else and they happen to be from New York, regardless of what your difference is, at least you know something about this. You know, you guys have something in common, and it's a bond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being from New York and, like, kind of sort of speaking that language, that street language, whatever, it definitely helps you. It doesn't hurt you.
Sleep, sleep, sleep. A magical thing. I dream of going to sleep every time I wake up. But honestly, if you don't love your bed, then sleep is more like a nightmare. If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you've got to try a Purple mattress, the world's most scientific mattress. It was developed by an actual rocket scientist, and it feels like you're sleeping in zero gravity. Right now, get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress when you text PD to 84888. You'll love Purple. It uses breathable material so you can sleep cool, too. The mattress is both firm and soft to provide support and comfort. Right now, PD Stories listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Again, just text PD to 84888. The only way to get this free pillow is to text PD to 84888. That's PD to 84888. Message and data rates may apply.
Harvey Weinstein, the once powerful Hollywood movie producer, now has a new title to add to his name, convicted rapist. Now that Harvey Weinstein has been convicted in the state of New York, Court Junkie, with the help of the Law and Crime Trial Network, goes behind the scenes to take a look at what exactly happened at trial. We delve into each day's testimony and get exclusive access to what the jury heard and didn't hear. Subscribe to Court Junkie on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the creators of Cold Case Files and PD Stories comes the next great true crime podcast, I Survived. Each week, I Survived presents chilling first-person accounts from people who overcame deadly situations, allowing the survivors to describe the events as they unfolded and how they made it out alive. If you love true crime, you are going to love I Survived. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, PodcastOne.com, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app so you can get new episodes every week. How long were you in uniform before you transitioned into detective?
I worked in probably like 3 or 4 years because I started doing warrants on a precinct level, and that was in plain clothes. That was fun. That was the most fun I've had in a job, being in warrants. It was everything you like about police work. You did a couple of background checks, figure out where the person is. You get one chance at this person. So you got to do all your computer checks, you know, and then just, you know, think, where is the best place to get this person? Sometimes you got a couple of different addresses. Sometimes you have a place of employment.
Tip your hand too
soon. Yeah, yeah. This person's going to be gone. Because in the neighborhoods that I worked in, people have 3 or 4 different places where they could lay their head for a while if they have to. Grandma's over here, their aunt is over there. And then the best part of it is you don't have to spend that much time with them once you arrest them. Because hanging out with somebody that you just arrested, if you can just imagine, is not the most comfortable or the best part of anybody's day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just took their freedom.
Yeah. As nice as you want to be to them, you feel bad. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And this way, you just bring them right to court. They're out of your hands, and the paperwork is minimal.
Mark, did you ever catch anyone when you were off duty that was wanted or saw committing a crime?
I remember one time I had a warrant for somebody, and I remember the particular guy's face real well. And I was at an IHOP, and I was out with my kids. And so at the time, I made a phone call. I said, listen, I called my base. And I said, that guy that we were looking for with that warrant, he's here right now. So our base was like, I don't know, half a mile away. Mm-hmm. Just drove over. I lived in that neighborhood, which usually is not the best idea, but it just so happened that mm-hmm. I was convenience that way. But they came over and they pulled him out. He never knew what happened.
Step away from the pancakes.
He never knew what happened, man. And another time I was out shopping, I was in the Home Depot, once again with my son, and this guy pulls me over and goes, you know, that I locked him up once, mm-hmm. you know? And then I was like, oh, that's great.
Good to see you again.
I hope everything's working out. I mean, he introduced me to his kids. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. That happens every once in a while. You know, that's why you got to be careful, man. You treat everybody like a gentleman, you know? No matter what the circumstances are, there before the grace of God go I. Mm-hmm. You know, you never know what put this person there. I remember going to the shelters all the time, you know, pick up people on warrants. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take long for me to talk to a couple people there. Like, this guy's divorced. He's got all his tools underneath his bed. He's going to work in the morning. The divorce settlement killed him. This guy, he lost his house in a fire, whatever. You know, now he's saving up to get another apartment. Don't judge people. No, you never know, man. And I remember when I was going through my divorce, I was thinking, wow, it was one of my fears. I was like, I'm going to wind up at a shelter right now. Somehow it all worked out, thank God.
I always say, always be humble and kind.
Yeah, man, you can never go wrong with treating somebody well.
You ever had to get in a real foot chase?
It was a homicide, but it wasn't my case. I came in to do the 4-1, and it was something that happened during the day tour. So the arresting officer, detective, asked me if I would help him take a ride downtown just to drop off the perp. So I said, yeah, right. It's not something I really wanted to do. I mm-hmm. had my own work, but we got to work together as a team. So I told this guy, because whenever me and this guy are together, something always happens. Mm. I said, nothing bad. Nothing's going to happen. Don't worry about it. As soon as we get to the guy, to the car, I'm trying to put the key in the lock. The guy's rear cuffed, by the way. He's like a 17-year-old kid. He's like a wide receiver. He's like 6'1", 165 pounds. He kicks me, and my back is to him, in the back of the leg, and then breaks away from my partner and takes off down the
block. Behind his back.
Oh, you should have seen him running away. It was the most graceful thing I've ever seen in my life. And like, if the whole time all I keep thinking about is my name on the paper tomorrow. New York's dumbest, you know? Like, two cops lose a homicide guy. Luckily, the guy I was working with was smart enough to go over the radio, and there happened to be an anti-crime car going down Amsterdam Avenue, and they ran into him, and then they caught him, thank God. Uh-huh. And that was, you know, you forget these things sometimes, but that was an incident that was pretty embarrassing, really, to tell you the truth.
Now, when did you leave NYPD? How many years did you put in?
I put in 20 years.
20 years?
20 years, like, it was 20 in a wake-up. Remember I told you I got on June 30th, 1992? Mm-hmm. I retired June 30th, 2012.
And after that, what did you decide to do with the rest of your life?
Well, I was already acting and doing stand-up comedy prior to that.
Oh, okay.
So then I just pursued it now full-time. And in hindsight, you know, you say, maybe I could have done another 5 years. Because you do another 5 years in the NYPD that used to be underneath my tier, you get what's called a 60th. And then that brings you up to an extra $1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm. So 20 years you get a pension, but 25 you get a bigger pension.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I wound up getting divorced. So that's why I always think about that extra $1,000. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, in those 5 years, I did a lot of things. I made a lot of TV appearances, Comedy Central. I had a one-man show called 20 and Out that was in the Fringe Festival. But I can't even tell you how many things I did. I used to write for a primetime series. But if you put all those things together, it amounts to nothing right now, because I wish I had that $1,000 every single month.
Really?
Yeah, man. Screw that stuff, man. That's $1,000. I already spent that money. It would have kept coming.
So when did you actually start doing stand-up? How old were you when you started?
Once I got in the police department, I said, I want to try this now. And I started taking acting classes, and then I got into a theater company. And then I started, once I started acting, then I found a path that led to stand-up somehow. And that's what I've been doing for over 20 years now.
What was your first acting gig?
I played a boxer on this TV show called Della Ventura. It was Danny Aiello's show.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, he was a private eye.
Uh-huh.
And I played, I think his name was Chris Fraken.
Uh-huh.
And it was a pretty big part, especially for the first time on TV. It was TV shows, episodics, had broken up into two parts, the A story and the B story, and that was the A story, which meant I had like 8 scenes. And it was a lot of memorizing, and it was a great way to come out of the gate, I tell you that. And it was, you know, after that, I haven't gotten a part that big since, but even though I did a commercial 2 years ago, that was it turned out to be a web series / commercial for Optimum. That was pretty long. That was about, but between that, that's a big gap between that and doing one lines all the time.
Tell me about your acting on Law & Order SVU.
Oh, wow. That was a dream come true. I had auditioned for Law & Order, one form or another, for over 20 years.
Really?
At least a couple times a year. It was so annoying not getting the part. You know, because I was a cop, and a lot of times I was auditioning to play a cop. Like, how do you screw up one line? Oh, the body's over there. I hope you didn't eat breakfast. Like, how do you not? Just give me the part, man. I'll be out of your hair. I'll never come back again. Just give me the freaking part.
One time.
Just once. So after so many years, I finally go in to read for Law & Order SVU, and it wasn't even a cop this time. Now it was George, the evidence clerk. And I remember leaving the audition feeling like I botched it up. And then they called me up, like, oh, you got a call back. So I was like, oh, okay. So I went back, and then I messed it up even worse. And then they said, you got the part. So I was like, oh, I finally get a hang of it now. I know what I'm supposed to do. Suck.
So you thought you blew the audition.
Yeah.
And that's the one that got you a role on SVU.
Yeah. It was fun to do the show. I told everybody and their mother that I was going to be on the show. I posted it like crazy on social media because I got this, you know, off my back. Mm-hmm. Something that I always wanted to do. They say you're not a New York City actor until you've been on Law & Order. So now, but I also have to explain to people, it's a small part. When I tell people it's a small part, they was always kind enough. They would always say to me, there's no such thing as a small part.
Right.
And then I would always say to them, I said, listen, if you only have one line, and while you're saying your one line, they're rolling the credits over your face. It's a small part. Trust me, okay? Don't blink. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
So when you started developing your stand-up routine, mm-hmm. was it about being a cop? Was that the focal point?
No. When I first started doing stand-up, I was scared to talk about being a cop. I just didn't, I didn't want the hassle that came along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want the job to know that I was doing it. So I have a stage name, Mark DeMayo. My real name is Mayo Sanchez, Mayo Anex Sanchez. That's my Dominican name. Mark DeMayo is a stage name.
Oh.
So I had created this other persona that I used to do my entertaining in. And that way I had a separate from the job. Not that the job ever did stand in the way. The job was more than 100% behind me. I mean, it took me a while because you don't trust everybody, you know. All it takes is one person that's a little jealous and be like, oh, I had my off-duty employment papers and, you know, towards the end of my career because then I realized, okay, you know, you're doing this for real. Keep it all on the level. But in the beginning, you know, sometimes you're at a comedy club and a fight breaks out, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And you're a cop.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I'm a comedian right now.
So you put your off-duty papers in. What does that mean?
It's a request. It's a form to fill out. You're requesting permission to work off-duty. Not every job you can take. Like, for example, if I wanted to be a bouncer in a bar,
mm-hmm.
what bar? Some bars have, they're off-limits. There's a bunch of locations in New York City that if you're a cop and you're out drinking off duty and something pops off in there and it's on this list, it's called the off-limits list. I don't know if they still have it now, but they used to have it when I was on mm-hmm. the job. And that meant you weren't supposed to be in that. You were supposed to check before you go out drinking if the bar you're going to drink in is on the off-duty list.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so that could get you jammed up. But as far as off-duty employment, what are you doing? Is it for cash? That's a big no-no too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a legitimate company? And is there, I don't know how much.
Would you be armed at that job doing that off-duty work
too?
Well,
they're asking you that, yeah.
They're asking you because.
Yeah. They want to be able to say yes or no for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have off-duty employment that's like regulated by the police department. You could work at Macy's or something like that, you know, at the door, at a bank,
mm-hmm.
an eatery. You know, so these guys, they have other sources of off-duty employment.
But there are guidelines.
If that place has been known as a drug hangout and now all of a sudden you're frequenting there, something's not right. You know, you should have known better. If you live in a certain neighborhood, you know, but if you don't, you got to check that list
mm-hmm.
before you go there.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Sometimes you could just walk into a place, look around and be like, oh, this is probably on the off-duty list. No, off-limits list. This place looks too good. There's too much fun going on here. This place has to be off-limits.
And when did you know you wanted to be a comedian? When did that seed get planted in your spirit?
You know what? It was one of those things that scared me. The same way I had this little fear in my gut when I decided that I wanted to start acting. I knew it was something hard to try. Same thing with stand-up. It was just like, and especially when you get a laugh, there's nothing too many, it's nothing like it really, you know? Mm-hmm. You get up on that stage, you get a laugh, and you can get one back to back and three in a row. Psh, oh, man.
It's addictive.
It's a beautiful thing, man.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's like riding a wave, man. It's like riding a wave.
Now, what big comedians, famous comedians, have you worked around or worked with or been in the same club
with? I mean, imagine. I'm from New York. I did comedy my whole 20 years in New mm-hmm. York. I've done tons of shows with, you name it, Bill Burr, Jim Gaffigan. I've been on more than a few shows with Dave Chappelle, Tracy Morgan, you know, the cast of SNL, Pete Davidson. You know, he's a great guy, even though sometimes he gets in a little trouble. But you name it. There's not a comic that's in New York that I haven't worked with before.
You ever done stand-up at a cop convention?
All the time. And what I'm trying to do right now is bridge together the gap between the police department and comedy, you know, where I can do, I can be of service in both.
Being a police officer is and can be a very stressful job. Did you find it stressful when you were a cop? Did you have periods where it was stressful and it was, you know, kind of affecting your life when you weren't on the job, when you were at home,
I'll tell you
or
something.
Your family.
All right. I stressed out when I worked in the squad
mm-hmm.
because when you work in a detective squad in New York City, you're constantly catching cases
mm-hmm.
and you're accountable for those cases and you want to bring the perpetrators to justice. But it's a building caseload and it's never ending. And these guys work very, very, very hard. It's not an 8-hour day. You know, if you want to be a decent detective in a detective squad here in New York City, it's a 10, 12-hour day, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then those are even days. That's not the days you're making an arrest and rocking around the clock.
So, or going to court.
Yeah. And those, that becomes stressful. It becomes stressful because it's a wear and tear on any relationships that you have at home, your obligations. If you have a family, you want to at least be, try to be half helpful to your spouse, you know, when it comes to kids and stuff like that. So that's where your stress comes in. Who knows what other people's problems are. We don't make a lot of money, but people get themselves in, you know, the average debt that every American gets involved in, a house, maybe a little bit house, bigger or nicer than you actually could have afforded. And now you're
getting
relying,
in debt.
Yeah, now you're relying on overtime. God forbid you get in a line of duty injury or you know, now you're out sick for a while, you can't make your overtime. These are the things that stress out a lot of officers. I really think that, you know, there has to be a program where police officers can go and talk to a therapist or a clinician. And the stigma that's attached to it is that you don't want to be that one. But if everybody had to go, as soon as you come out of the academy, the way they give you a doctor
mm-hmm.
for your career.
Mm-hmm.
That's your basically your, I forget what the name of it is right now. That's the doctor you go see when you go out sick. Make people go for just to talk to somebody twice a year, maybe once a year, you know? And if you want to extend the conversation, then you could. But at least everybody has to go. because we're all suffering from these little PTSD things, you know? And the little things at first, seeing a dead body. Most people, you shouldn't see a dead body, you know, a lot.
But as a police officer, you will.
Yeah, and some of them are in better shape than others. So that might stay with you. Hearing a story or talking to a victim, you know, and all these things, that little, these tiny little things that they add up, and on top of it, you can't make your bills. So that's where the stress comes in. I work in the academy right now. I just came from there.
The police academy?
Yeah, I do. I'm an actor there. I do scenarios on how to handle mental illness. There's a program called CIT, Crisis Intervention Tactics. And police officers come. They sit in the audience. They're in service. It's a four-day course. And they hear about mental different type of mental illnesses. And then the second half of the class, actors come in and act those out. And they get pulled two volunteers out of the audience. They have to go in and handle the job. Comes over as a radio run. And they're getting exposed to somebody who has PTSD, somebody who's borderline, somebody who's schizophrenic. I do suicide cop, a jumper, depressed person, autism, dementia.
Mark, can you explain what a suicide cop is?
One of the scenarios that we do is we've entitled it Suicide Cop. But it's trying to create a scenario where you come across a member of the service who happens to be intoxicated and also armed and not in the right frame of mind.
A police officer?
Yes. He's an off-duty police officer who's had a bit too much to drink, but not drink party-wise. He's in depression mode right now.
And armed.
Yes. So the scenario is how to train police officers, basically, when you respond to that scene, even though he's a member of the service, there you have to follow, the police protocol. You know, he has to be disarmed. You have to call a bus for an ambulance for him. We're going to get him some help. That is the way you want the scenario to end, with him getting help.
You proud of your service with NYPD?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. That's why I go out every single day, and I try to promote it more. You know, we have our own, with the stand-up, my one-man show. I have a podcast that I do as well.
What's that?
It's called Police Off the Cuff. I do it with a retired homicide sergeant. His name is Bill Cannon.
Well, thanks for being here on PD Stories.
That's it.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh my God.
Wow, thank you so much, man.
Thank you, man. This was a pleasure for me, too. I wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk, with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.